You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
As Afghans cast their ballots in a presidential election this weekend, in light of President Obama's announcement of the withdrawal of most of the American troops by the end of this year, Afghanistan's future appears to be increasingly uncertain. After almost 13 years of war, reporter Anand Gopal looks in his most recent book, No Good Men Among the Living, at what went wrong in Afghanistan from the perspective of Afghans themselves. It's published by Metropolitan Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Anand Gopal, who has served as the Afghanistan correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, back to our show. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You chose three Afghans to focus on. What roles did each of them play during the war?
Well, the first, his name was Mullah Cable. He had that quite unusual name because he used to wield a whip, a metal whip, during the Taliban regime. He was a major commander at the time. And I follow his life over 13 years.
You've seen that whip on what?
Well, his job was actually to go into villages after the Taliban had conquered and find people who still had weapons. And basically, if you didn't give up your weapons, you'd be whipped.
So you describe these three people as an enemy, an ally, and a civilian. He was the enemy.
He was the enemy. That's right.
And the ally?
And the ally was a man named John Muhammad, or the U.S. military used to call him JMK for short. He was a very close ally of the military. He was an Afghan politician. He was a governor of a rural province. I think many people would actually call him a warlord.
And then the third one is a woman.
Third is a woman. She's a housewife named Hila who grew up in Kabul and then fled to the countryside during the war.
How did you find the Taliban fighter Akbar Gul?
Well, it was the result of many years of me trying to get to the Taliban because, you know, I had reported from the U.S. side. I had embedded with U.S. troops. And, of course, I was very interested on the other side and what motivated them to fight him.
But reporters who have tried to contact the Taliban often find themselves in captivity. Was it dangerous?
It was. You have to be very careful. I did this back in 2008 when it was still possible to get letters from the Taliban leadership to meet Taliban fighters.
Was he suspicious of you as an American journalist?
He was very suspicious. And more so, he was suspicious that I would have to go and check his stories. He thought that I was somehow spying on him.
How honest do you think he was in his accounts of battles and other incidents?
He was fairly honest, but, you know, I found instances where he claimed that he killed 10 or 15 U.S. soldiers, and I'd go dig through the archives and find out that nobody was killed. And I don't know if he knew that or not, but certainly he was self-serving.
You also refer to him in two different names throughout the book.
No, that's right. Yeah, Mullah Cable was his nom de guerre, as it were, but his real name was Akbar Gul.
Many people, including observers in this country, saw the Taliban takeover as an improvement during the Civil War that had followed the Soviet withdrawal in the 1990s because the country was in total chaos. People in Afghanistan expected the United States to play a more direct role in the country after the Soviets left?
They did. I mean, and there was this, because the U.S. had supported the Mujahideen, who were the Islamic fighters who fought against the Soviets. And so there was expectation that that would continue. And one of the reasons the Civil War happened is because all of that funding had stopped.
But also because those warlords were all fighting for power amongst themselves. One of them, Hekmatyar, I understand, was dropping mortar shells on Kabul because he had been left out of the government.
Well, he was actually nominally the president of the country, so he has the distinction of being one of the only presidents to actually shell his own capital city.
And what did he think he was accomplishing? Was he making friends?
He was certainly not making friends. It was a mad scramble for power. These are all people who had guns and money coming to them for 10 years from the CIA. Once that stopped, they had men to feed and support, and so they turned to each other to raise funds.
Do people in Afghanistan think that things would have been different if the United States hadn't just dropped the ball at that point?
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, the reason why you have these illegal checkpoints that these warlords run is because there's maybe 30 or 40 guys that they have to pay and feed. And if they don't have a source of funding from the outside, they're going to extract it from the population.
The Taliban then came in, settled things down in a very awful way. They were in power from 1996 to 2001, and Al-Qaeda was there. What was that alliance like?
Well, actually, Al-Qaeda and bin Laden showed up before the Taliban had actually taken power.
Because they had been part of the war against the Soviets.
Right, and they came there on the invitation of these warlords, essentially. Mm-hmm. But the Taliban sort of inherited them. And it was a fraught alliance because on the one hand, there was Taliban leaders who didn't want to turn them out because they worried how that would look to the quote-unquote Muslim world. On the other hand, they also recognized, especially a section of the Taliban leadership recognized that keeping bin Laden there was going to just bring a lot of ruin to the country.
Was there a philosophical divide?
I think it was a practical political divide, actually. And there was a lot of debates within the Taliban leadership.
Because they're both fundamentalists both Sunni fundamentalist groups.
They are. They come from different traditions. You know, for example, the Taliban love shrines and Al-Qaeda and their ilk hate shrines. So there are differences between them in that sense, too.
Didn't Al-Qaeda support the Taliban financially, which made the relationship a little more complicated?
Yeah. I mean, this is really why it was a marriage of convenience, because turning out Al-Qaeda also meant cutting off the funding for the war the Taliban was fighting against the Northern Alliance.
In his address on September 11, 2001, George W. Bush said, "We will make no distinction between the terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them." Was his speech even seen in Afghanistan? Because wasn't TV banned?
Yeah, TV was banned. There was radio at the time. But yeah, even today, most people don't know about 9/11 in rural Afghanistan.
They don't know that it even happened?
They don't know what happened, or if they do, they have all sorts of strange ideas about it.
What did they think was happening when the United States invaded then?
This is what people ask me. They say, why did the United States invade Afghanistan?
The Taliban refused to extradite Osama bin Laden, even though he was obviously a thorn in their side. Why did they do that?
Well, the Taliban leader, Mullah Omar, he's somebody who's from a very poor kind of provincial background. He's not a major religious cleric. And so he was always worried about religious legitimacy. And so he was concerned, how would it look if I handed over bin Laden to a secular court? And what would that do to my legitimacy?
The Taliban wanted to transfer bin Laden to a neutral third country. Should the United States have accepted that offer?
In retrospect, given that we're still at war 13 years later, I think that would have been the best bet.
Shouldn't the Taliban have suspected that the United States would invade after that didn't happen?
Well, actually, this is a point of debate among the Taliban leadership. A lot of them thought that the U.S. wouldn't invade because, remember, a few years before, in 1998, after bin Laden had attacked, I believe, the USS Tanzania and embassy, U.S. embassy in Tanzania, the U.S. had sent missiles to Afghanistan. So they figured there'll be some missiles. They didn't expect an invasion.
There was also an attack on a Sudanese pharmaceutical facility,
right,
if I remember correctly.
Right,
that was
yeah.
The Clinton administration. You give a startling account of the battle for Tir an-Nakhot. Why was that such a significant moment in the beginning of the war?
Well, the U.S. in 2001 were entirely supporting the Northern Alliance, so from the northern part of the country. They didn't really have any allies in the south. And this town of Tir an-Nakhot that I write about is a provincial town in the south, but it was one that had fallen on its own, but through basically a tribal uprising. And the Taliban sent maybe 100, 150 trucks full of soldiers to retake it. If they had retaken it, we may have seen a much longer protracted struggle to overthrow the Taliban. But the U.S. was able, through overwhelming air power, to take the town. And that's really what led to the Taliban's collapse.
Were you able to interview any eyewitnesses to the battle?
Well, in fact, I actually was able to interview people on both sides of the battle. One was a U.S. Special Forces soldier, Jason Amerin, and his counterpart in the Taliban, a guy named Mullah Manan. I was able to get both of their accounts, and in the book I kind of stitched them both together, and it was interesting to see how that battle looks from both perspectives.
What did the battle reveal about each side's military capability?
Well, it's extraordinary that, I mean, the Taliban are fighting they're fighting in sandals and with trucks and missile launchers on their shoulders, whereas the U.S. have access to the most sophisticated technology in the world.
On the other hand, the Taliban and many people in Afghanistan had fought successfully against the Soviet Union, which also was very sophisticated militarily. Would guerrilla warfare not have worked in this case?
You know, even with this in the Soviet war and in this war, you see that the rebels are able to take not able to take battles. They're not able to win battles. They're able to win a war by just existing and not being wiped out. And that was the case here too.
How quickly did news of the battle spread, and what was the consequence?
Well, almost immediately after the U.S. had retaken the town, you saw Taliban fighters throughout the South defect to the other side.
But not the leaders.
And the leaders, too. This is what prompted the Taliban leadership to come to the table and try to cut a deal.
Mullah Omar tried to surrender, but he had terms that were unacceptable to the United States?
He sent a delegation to Hamid Karzai, who was with the CIA and the Special Forces in that battle, and essentially said, "We accept your authority, and we will submit to living under your rule if you leave us alone," essentially.
In other words, conditional surrender rather than unconditional surrender.
That's right. I mean, they didn't want to be sent to Guantanamo or anything.
And like we were demanding unconditional surrender?
Unconditional surrender.
So as the Taliban was dissolving, what were the first steps taken to form a new U.S.-backed government?
There was a meeting in Bonn, Germany, in which about half of the Afghan opposition, which is the Northern Alliance side of things, basically got together, and supporters of the old king got together and inaugurated a new president.
Well, the Northern Alliance had lost its leader. Was it in a bit of disarray at this point?
It had been in disarray until the U.S. invasion. The surge of money and weapons to the Northern Alliance really cohered them around a common cause.
How did Hamid Karzai come to be a major figure in the new government?
Well, he has an interesting story, in fact, because he slipped into southern Afghanistan on a motorcycle to the area around Tirankot, this town, in an effort to try to stoke a tribal uprising. But that failed because he didn't really have the standing amongst the population.
He had no military background either.
No military background. He was basically an aid worker, essentially, in the 80s. But he had ties to the CIA, and that's essentially what enabled him to get the benefit of U.S. air power that helped him win the war.
Was Hamid Karzai known in Afghanistan at that time?
He was not a major national figure, but his family in southern Afghanistan was well known. They are one of the aristocratic tribes that have basically been in authority for many, many generations.
But he's not Pashtun.
He's Pashtun.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Because in the end, since the Pashtun are the largest group, I would assume that ultimately any leader of Afghanistan would come from that group. Well, but the Taliban are also come out of the Pashtun.
Taliban are also Pashtun, but this is why the U.S. wanted Karzai. They essentially anointed him as a leader because they didn't want the Northern Alliance, who are all ethnic minorities, to take power.
My guest is Anand Gopal, who has written, has covered Egypt, Syria, other international hotspots, but spent a lot of time in Afghanistan, writing for the Wall Street Journal, for other publications, and now he has a book called No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. It is published by Metropolitan Books, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Anand Gopal, G-O-P-A-L. His latest book, No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes, published by Metropolitan Books. The Americans came in. I would assume that they would tell people about 9/11. Were they not good at winning hearts and minds?
No, you know, they used to drop leaflets back then saying that our country has been attacked and that's why we're here. But the best way of getting the word out is dropping leaflets. It's not that effective.
Especially since many people can't read?
Most people can't read.
Who was the U.S.-backed warlord that you interviewed, this Jan Muhammad?
He was somebody who was a warlord in the 1990s, and he was conspiring against the Taliban, and so they caught him and put him in prison, tortured him pretty severely, and he was only released because of the invasion, and through his alliance with the U.S. forces, essentially got very wealthy and powerful.
Also had a relationship with Hamid Karzai?
Yeah, he was an old friend of Hamid Karzai.
What did the United States offer him in exchange for support?
He would give them intelligence, and when I say intelligence, I mean he would accuse people of being Taliban or Al-Qaeda.
So he was working the system. He was saying often, well, this guy who I don't like is Taliban, even if he wasn't?
Yeah, I mean, if you had a piece of land that he wanted, he would tell the U.S. military that you are al-Qaeda, and then they would arrest you.
Who were the enemy at this point? You say that many of the soldiers had fled the country and members of the Taliban renounced their political affiliation, often moved to the other side. So who were the Americans fighting?
Well, that's a good question, actually, because in 2002, there was no enemy. There was Taliban.
But there was fighting.
There was no fighting.
Oh.
There was one-way fighting in the sense that the U.S. was conducting raids, but nobody was shooting back at them. There was almost no violence directed at the U.S. in 2002 and 2003.
Many of the Taliban leaders fled to Pakistan. Was there an expectation the United States would confront Pakistan militarily at this time?
No. And, you know, Pakistan at that time was actually working with the U.S. They were actually arresting some of these Taliban leaders and sending them over to Guantanamo.
On the other hand, they have been accused, the Secret Service, Pakistani Secret Service, of supporting the Taliban and playing both ends against the middle.
I think this actually took root a little bit later after it became clear there was an insurgency to back in Afghanistan. And then Pakistan started playing both sides.
So this is a time, this early time of relative peace. Was there support among the Afghan people for this new government and this new situation?
And there was a widespread support because the Taliban were not a popular regime whatsoever.
And yet now it looks like the Taliban might be welcomed back by many people. Why have things deteriorated so much?
And I think this is the real tragedy. You know, there was no enemy to fight, but we were there to fight an enemy. And so these alliances with warlords like John Muhammad, whom I write about, actually incentivized faulty intelligence. So a lot of people were killed, a lot of people were arrested who were innocent or who were actually pro-U.S. and pro-Karzai.
Since we were getting bad intelligence from these Afghan warlords, who should we have been going to for intelligence?
Well, I mean, to start with, people who have weapons and who have a lot to gain from the intelligence, you know, that's not the place to go. I mean, I think there were civilian parts of the civilian world which you could actually talk to and find out what was happening.
Who's the civilian you focused on and how did you find her?
She was a housewife who grew up in Kabul during the Civil War. She fled the country during the fighting, fled the city during the fighting and went to the countryside where she found essentially that the social mores were very restrictive.
Weren't the social mores kind of loosened during the Soviet period and then got tighter under the warlords and very tight under the Taliban?
No, that's right. And in fact, when she came to the village where she ended up living, she was told that she couldn't leave the house no matter what. And the Taliban hadn't even existed yet. This is all because of the warlords.
And then under the Taliban, women could not leave the house either.
That's right.
Even accompanied by a man?
In her village, even accompanied by a man, women just were not allowed out of the house.
What happened to her husband?
So in 2004, he was working for the United Nations, and he was killed by a U.S.-backed warlord because he had uncovered some voter fraud, election fraud, in the presidential elections.
Would you argue that it was the rise of these U.S.-backed strongmen that encouraged the resurgence of the Taliban?
Well, absolutely, because we waded into a conflict that already had a 20-year history. And we chose one side, and that essentially incentivized the other side to continue fighting.
You call the war on terror the ultimate self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, you know, when you target people who were going to be pro-U.S. or pro-Karzai and force them to go to the other side and then label them an enemy, then that is sort of the self-fulfilling tendency.
Why did Akbar Gul decide to resume fighting for the Taliban?
Well, it's interesting because he actually quit the Taliban after the invasion and he opened up a cell phone shop, tried to make ends meet doing that essentially. He faced harassment from the police, the Afghan police. He faced harassment from warlords and also a lot of the tribal elders that he revered growing up were arrested and disappeared to Guantanamo or to Bagram. And so he felt that there was really no place for him in the political marketplace, essentially. So he went to the Taliban.
And the Taliban began to grow in numbers.
Yeah.
Where were they getting their financing?
Initially, mostly they raised it themselves. They were taxing the villages that they operated in, usually forcibly taxing the villages. And then later on, they also started getting money from the Gulf.
Was Jen Muhammad able to keep on using the Americans, or did it end at a certain point?
He was, but eventually in 2011, he got assassinated, probably by the Taliban, which is sort of the end state of a lot of these warlords.
You moved to Afghanistan in 2008. What made you decide to move there? Where the action was?
No, you know, actually, I was interested in Afghanistan from 9/11 because I lived down in lower Manhattan, and I knew people who were killed in the attacks. And so I was kind of fixated on the war on terror, and I wanted to find a way to get out there.
And then when you arrived, what did you find?
Well, I came in with very particular ideas of who the good guys were, who the bad guys were. And I ended up taking a motorcycle, growing a beard, and going around the country. And I found that in that process, a lot of my preconceived notions were actually wrong.
You visited Taliban country in the summer of 2008. Did you have to bring security with you?
No, I relied on trust and Afghan hospitality, which actually can take you a long way.
How did the conditions of the Taliban territory compare to the government-controlled areas?
Well, in the Taliban territories, there was no social services except for judicial services, which is important. There was courts. In government-controlled areas, there were some social services, but there was a lot of corruption.
You say in the book that when you arrived, you thought that it was a war of necessity and later came to think it was a war of choice.
Because the Taliban had surrendered in 2002, and we had the choice to accept that surrender, and perhaps we wouldn't be fighting this war today.
At least two of the Guantanamo detainees released this month in exchange for the return of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl are mentioned in your book, most notably Muhammad Nabi. How does your view of Nabi differ from the U.S. government's?
Well, Nabi's an interesting case because he was somebody who had switched sides in 2001 and joined the Afghan government and actually started working for the CIA. And then he was a victim of faulty intelligence by a rival warlord, and he ended up in Guantanamo, and he had been there ever since.
In a way, we perhaps have pushed him back into the arms of the Taliban?
Well, I mean, if there's anything that would push somebody back into the arms of the Taliban, I think being in Guantanamo for 12 years would do it.
But in this case, he would have felt, well, I was trying to help, and I wound up in prison.
I mean, he was on our side. There was no dispute about this. We actually didn't accept that.
My guest is Anand Gopal. His book, No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. It's published by Metropolitan Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Can you explain the title?
It comes from a proverb, a Pashtun proverb, which says, there are no good men among the living and no bad ones among the dead. And it was told to me by one of the people I follow in the book. And the idea is that there are no heroes or saviors in this conflict, that from the rural Afghan perspective, the warlords, the Taliban, the U.S. forces, all of them are causing problems. And the only way to go forward is to try to survive.
President Obama announced last month that he's withdrawing all but 9,800 American troops from Afghanistan before the end of the year and then the rest by the end of 2016. And many are arguing that that's too fast. What do you think?
You know, I think the troop levels aren't actually as important as the money. The Afghan army already has more firepower and manpower than the Taliban. But the real question is that the U.S. is funding the Afghan army, and if that stops, the army won't exist.
Inspector General John Sopko testified before Congress on the reconstruction in Afghanistan and cited the domestic annual revenue as only $2 billion, while its overall budget is $7.5 billion. Are they getting the majority of their aid from us?
Yeah. I mean, essentially, U.S. taxpayers are funding the existence of the Afghan state. And if that stops, the Afghan state will collapse.
Is anyone else sending money?
I mean, yeah, there are other the U.K., France, so there are other countries that are contributing. But essentially, the point is that the international community is propping up the state.
You write about the widespread corruption in the Karzai government. I'm assuming that corruption would be there even in the next government, whoever wins the election. So should we be sending this much money there?
Well, actually, I think a lot of the corruption is due to the amount of money that the U.S. has sent. If you talk to Afghans, they would say that in previous regimes, for whatever their faults were not nearly as corrupt as the current one. And if you take billions of dollars and throw it into a country that really doesn't have the capacity to absorb it, as what you do is you incentivize corruption on a massive scale.
You write that after 1991, the Afghan government crumbled, and the question of who would fill the vacuum, who would build a new state, has not been fully resolved to this day. Do you think the election this weekend will clarify any of those questions?
It won't. You know, there is a government that exists in the cities there, and in the countryside you have warlords and the Taliban, and that hasn't changed in the last 10 years.
President Obama proposed a bilateral security agreement, but Karzai refused to sign it. I never really understood why, although it's assumed that his successor will probably sign it.
Yeah, I think his successor will sign it. And Karzai, you know, he was somebody who was installed by the CIA. He was somebody who was seen by people in the rural countryside as being an American puppet. And he's very cognizant of that fact. And so he's playing up this nationalist card, saying that I will not sign this. I am, you know, somebody who defends the sovereignty of this nation, but I will allow the next government to sign it. And therefore, he'll come away with clean hands.
Violence seems to be escalating in Afghanistan. Just recently, we've seen headlines of a friendly fire incident that killed five. The Taliban kidnapped 27 officers, killed 22 civilians. There's talk in Congress of the freeing of Bo Bergdahl as an incentive for the Taliban to capture more Americans, although I would have assumed they would be attempting to capture them whether we had a prisoner exchange or not.
Yeah, I mean, that comes as news to anybody who's been to Afghanistan, who has to take extreme precautions not to be kidnapped by the Taliban, as they've had to do for the last 12 years.
Why do you think that that argument is being employed? Just simply because people are upset about this prisoner exchange?
Yeah, I mean, the exchange has become very politicized. But, you know, this is a war that's gone on for 12 years, and there are two entrenched sides. There's no end in sight. So, if anything can lead to a negotiated settlement, I think that would actually be a positive thing.
What about the Afghan constitution? Is it a good constitution if it's abided by?
If it's abided by, it's one of the best constitutions in the world. In fact, it mandates that a quarter of all seats in parliament go to women, which is better than our country.
And the woman that you write about here is a senator.
She was a senator.
She was a senator?
Yeah. And she's a beneficiary of this constitution.
But isn't there still a certain amount of ambivalence about the rights of women? I remember seeing a documentary film about the equivalent of the American... Well, there was a music contest. A woman won it, and then she received death threats.
Well, that's right. This is why the Constitution is good
on paper.
It's
called Afghan Star.
Afghan Star, right. The Constitution is good on paper, but, I mean, if you take, for example, Hila, the woman I write about, she was living in her village and running secret schools to educate girls in 2004. I mean, the Taliban were long gone by that point. So the problems that women face are much deeper than the sort of simple binary of Taliban and non-Taliban.
Even a presidential candidate, Abdullah, narrowly escaped an assassination attempt last week, and six others were killed. What efforts will be made by the remaining 9,800 American forces to keep this violence down?
Well, I worry that the remaining forces will actually contribute to the violence, because a lot of these forces, I think almost 2,000 of them, are special forces who are conducting night raids and targeted killings.
Did the campaign talk much about the Taliban and the possibility that some kind of an agreement could be worked out in the future?
You know, it's become a campaign point to say we want to negotiate with the Taliban, but it's unclear whether either side, they're actually serious about that.
The United States pointed out that in the negotiations for Bo Bergdahl, that we were negotiating with a good part of the Taliban, that there are the good Taliban and the bad Taliban. Is the Taliban fragmented?
The Taliban is fragmented, absolutely. There are Taliban who want peace talks, and there are others who say we should just wait until the U.S. leaves.
Just one other thing. We're not hearing much about opium poppies these days, but isn't that still a major part of the Afghan economy?
Yeah, it was a bumper harvest this year. If you actually count it as part of the GDP, I think it's more than half of the GDP is opium.
And will we ever be able to resolve our problems with Afghanistan as long as that's the case?
No, but I think this is a consequence of deeper problems of security first and everything else second.
Let's get back to the premise of your book. The subtitle is America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. Americans, you say, were welcomed in 2001. Now what's the general feeling? Go home?
Well, Afghanistan is a divided country now. You know, you have – the war is only being fought in half the country. So in the other half, where it's peaceful, people want the U.S. to stay because they see them as a buffer against a return to the dark days of the Civil War. In the south, where the war is being fought, it is Yankee go home. It's Taliban go home. Warlords go home.
But in the south is where the Taliban had their – were pretty much based. Kandahar was the Taliban's center, capital, whereas Kabul is the capital of this new Afghanistan.
Well, that's right. And this is why there's a lot of frustration amongst my Afghan friends, because the Taliban are part of the country. They're not going to go anywhere. But they can hope that the U.S. will go home.
Anand Gopal's book, No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes, published by Metropolitan Books. Are you going to go back?
I'll keep going back, yeah.
Thank you so much for coming to our show.
Thank you.